Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking about the development of the labour movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in Great Britain, and particularly the emergence of the Labour Party. A working class movement had been developing since the end of the Napoleonic Wars. One only needs to look at the period of protest between 1815 and 1848. With the development of radical groups such as the Blanketeers, the Luddites, and eventually the development in the late 1830s of the Chartist movement, demanding the adoption of a people's charter in Great Britain. The failure of the Chartist movement after 1848 was largely the result of an enormous and rapid economic boom that Britain went through, but also the development of a new type of trade unionism, the New Model Unions. The New Model Unions were the unions of skilled workers. Skilled workers such as engineers, a great example of New Model Unionism, if you want to quote it, is the ASC, the Amalgamated Society of Engineers. These were unions who were closed shops, really, for highly skilled workers. And this is part of the development of a kind of a schism within Britain's working classes between skilled workers and unskilled. And there was less kind of protest, less of an emphasis on strikes and walkouts and lockouts and that sort of thing. And they were really about ensuring the cohesiveness of the profession and the status of skilled workers in terms of pay. They involved the provision of services for members, such as illness insurance, sickness insurance, in times of hardship, which were paid for by subscription. So these were, to make an analogy between them and the guilds of the Middle Ages is very clumsy and something that's kind of not quite fitting, but they had more of a kind of a role in protecting and supporting individual crafts than they did thinking in terms of workers' solidarity or a wider working class movement. And they're quite expensive to be members of. So they are prohibitively so for sort of less skilled or unskilled workers don't get to be in them because of the cost and the lack of a trade. They were also the New Model Unions. They tended to protect skilled workers against other workers. They are not so much a focus of protest against an oppressive managing sort of capitalist class. But they are about keeping the status of skilled workers as part of what would be referred to as labour aristocracy. The second half of the 19th century sees a real transformation in the labour movement. It becomes a far more politicised and class-based set of institutions. Radicals looked upon the new unions as kind of betrayers of the working class. They were there really to look after a small section of the working class, but not the class as itself. And they had really made their peace with the capitalist system and looked to see what skilled workers could get out of it. This is more than understandable in a way. This is how institutions work for their members. You have to wait really till the 1880s for a kind of a new wave of union development. Now, confusingly, the new model unions are developed in the 1850s, and the wave of unionism that develops in the 1880s is new unionism, not to be confused with new model unionism. The new unionism was the development of large unions, giant unions, which were designed to cater for unskilled workers. These were, by their very nature, more confrontational. The Dockers Union, particularly in the 1880s and 90s, has a series of confrontations with the owners of docks in London and the South ports, which are violent, they are confrontational, and they are really, really quite seminal moments in the labour movement, the strike for the Dockers Tanner. And it's these new unions that have a far more amicable relationship with the various socialist parties and organisations that have existed and developed in the 1880s. The idea that property should be abolished, that the resources of Great Britain should be put into common ownership, and that capitalism itself is a kind of a monstrous and exploitative concept. These are all ideas that are quite prevalent among the new unions and among the various different socialist organisations that develop. The most prolific one in London by 1881 was Henry Hindman's Social Democratic Federation. Hindman was an admirer of Marx. I think Marx probably was vaguely aware of his existence. Hindman was a member of the gentry who had decided to renounce his title and status and become a member of the revolutionary socialist underground. The Social Democratic Federation were advocated a forcible overthrow of the capitalist system, and people like Henry Hindman were quite well connected in London with the various anarchist emigres from Russia and France and Spain and Italy and across Europe. He never really quite acquires the status of some of the more famous ones, like kind of Enrico Malatesta or any of the disciples of Mikhail Bakunin. But very much, when you read between the lines, Hindman is very much kind of riding on the coattails of greater figures within the revolutionary left. The democratic left in 1884 sees the development of the Fabian Society. The Fabian Society, named after the Roman general Fabius, who his strategy was to encircle cities and to wear them down gradually. And they believed that that's what they were going to do with capitalism, was to encircle it and gradually wear it down. They were not revolutionaries. These were upper and middle class intellectuals and progressives who believed that a peaceful path to socialism could be had, They had a belief in Robert Owen's mutualism, where which was the ideas that founded the cooperative movement, that workers should all have a share of the proceeds of what they create. And the leading figures within the Fabian movement were Sidney and Beatrice Webb, of whom I've spoken many times before, George Bernard Shaw, and later people such as H.G. Wells. And a long way down the line in the 1930s, when Sidney and Beatrice are in their dotage, the experience of the Great Depression makes them come to the conclusion that capitalism can't be reformed. And they take rather a shine to Soviet Russia at this point. So a great deal of the work of the Fabians was analytical. They did a great deal of social research into trade unions, the condition of the working classes, and they provide an awful lot of the kind of the intellectual underpinning of the labour movement. Sidney Webb writes the Labour Party's constitution in 1918, particularly with reference to clause 4, the public ownership of the commitment to public ownership. Okay, so the in 1893, the Independent Labour Party is born. Now, it's important not to confuse the ILP with the Labour Party, of which we're going to talk about it in a moment. It really is a very different creature altogether. It's linked to the trade unions and with Methodism and other nonconformist branches of Christianity. And the strategy that the Independent Labour Party wanted to pursue was a parliamentary one. They wanted to get a socialist party into parliament for the first time. The movement on the left is aided immensely by the development of the Trade Union Congress, which was a kind of a federation movement for the trade union movement in general. And they wanted to see if they could coordinate the workings of unions. They wanted to give unions more unity with one another so that they weren't being played off against one another by employers. Period throughout the 1890s is also a kind of a golden age for the left, because in Britain, the 1890s is a period of acute recession and an economic crisis. Numbers of unemployed of unemployed increase, but not sufficiently to weaken the unions. Normal economic theory has it during the 20th century, when you do have the phenomena of mass unemployment in the millions, that having what Marx would refer to as a reserve labour army, i.e. a large number of potential workers or unemployed people, that tends to drive down wages. It tends to make people less likely to cooperate with one another against employers because they're desperate for work, and it tends to make the union movement in general an awful lot weaker. One of the most significant test cases of the period was the Lyons versus Wilkins ruling. J. Lyons and Sons took the Amalgamated Society of Leather Workers to court in 1896, claiming that when the society had gone out on strike, that union pickets, union members standing at the factory gates trying to dissuade other workers from going in, had intimidated workers who wished to go and continue working. Wilkins was the trade union official. Wilkins, in the case, the Lyons versus Wilkins case, was the official who was named in the action, so was seen as chiefly responsible. The judgment basically said that the union was in the wrong, that the workers had a right to work, and the implication was that it was illegal to picket to prevent workers from getting to their jobs. The counsel for the union, the legal representatives of the union, said that, you know, in 1875, Disraeli's Trade Union Act had permitted pickets attending in order to obtain.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And communicate information. And the judges basically said that, well, in this case, there's no difference between simply being there and communicating information, which is on one hand legal, and what you're doing, which is harassment or watching and besetting, as they called it. So this is not lawful, and this has a damaging effect on the union movement. There are, of course, in this period more militant unions anyway, which seem to be able to articulate this deep-seated and often unspoken anger by the unskilled working class. Their living conditions, and in 1897, TUC member unions, who are the TUC by this point is dominated by the new unions, they vote to allow the TUC to become more militant. In 1899, the TUC pushed for a new initiative that made sure that working class representation in the House of Commons occurred. And this is where really you get the Labour Representation Committee of 1900, which is the embryonic Labour Party. So the Labour Representation Committee draws together the unions, the Independent Labour Party, the Fabians and Henry Hyman's Social Democrats into an alliance. And this is part of the reason why even now, kind of 116 years on, you have a Labour Party which is, when you look into it, a whole federation of different groups and interests and different takes on what the idea of democratic socialism is meant to be. The Independent Labour Party would be a force within the Labour Representation Committee, but would eventually be forced out overall by the 1930s. In many ways, the Labour Party has been a kind of never-ending civil war for most of its existence. If you look at the ministries of Ramsay MacDonald, the shadow ministries of Hugh Gaitskell, Harold Wilson, James Callaghan throughout the 1980s, Neil Kinnock and Militant. Tony Blair seemed to have throttled the left in the party, but under the guise of Jeremy Corbyn, it has returned with a vast kind of grassroots membership. So there has been this kind of struggle within the Labour Party throughout most of its existence, on and off. So initially, only two Labour MPs were elected from the Labour Representation Committee, and this was in 1900. But in 1906, it does an awful lot better. What had happened in the meantime had been the Taff Vale case. In 1900, the Amalgamated Society of Railway Servants and the Railwaymen's Trade Union had gone on strike against the Taff Vale Railway Company here in Wales, which was refusing to recognise the union as the representative of its employees for negotiating paying conditions. When the union went on strike in August 1900, to force the company to back down, the Taff Vale Company reacted, and they were of the opinion they were good employers, that they hadn't done anything wrong, and therefore that the strike action was malicious, was punitive. The company had, you know, a reasonably good track record of dealing with its workers. It had a pension scheme and reasonably good conditions relative to the times. The High Court grants the Taff Vale Company an injunction against the strike to declare the strike illegal. The union then overturned this injunction. And the question arises throughout the course of the conflict as to whether the union can be held liable if the strike is deemed to be illegal for costs incurred to the company. And if this was the case, then this would have a massive effect on strike action up and down the land. In 1901... the union was sued for losses and was hit with a bill of £23,000 plus costs of £20,000, which virtually bankrupts the union. And the Labour Representation Committee sees on this and they say, well, you've effectively, judicially and economically banned the right to strike. No union can afford it. It's impossible. And the Labour Representation Committee's goal, therefore, in Parliament is now to prevent unions from being sued for losses resulting from strike action. And therefore, the Labour Representation Committee believe that only a significant, large working-class party in the House of Commons can have any effect in this at all. That workers' rights will continue to be overthrown and prorogued whenever this doesn't exist. In 1906, the committee win 29 seats in Parliament, partly through a deal with the Liberals, who they have an electoral pact with. The Liberals, of course, in 1906 win a landslide election and sweep the Conservatives away. And the Liberals begin to really shift towards the question of social reform, new liberalism. Emerges away from the old kind of laissez-faire liberalism, and it's all about state intervention and improving the conditions of the poor. And they do this really, the likes of Asquith and Lloyd George do this really, because they can feel the popularity of the Labour Party snapping at their heels. In 1910, the Labour Party, as it's now called, returns 40 MPs to Parliament, and they are on the cusp of turning into a significant electoral force. And the second election that year, the Labour Party win another two seats. So they win 40, they're at 42. The problem of funding is always a significant issue, but overall there was a apparent upward trajectory in the party's fortunes. But you have to bear in mind the following things. In 1906, there were 29 Labour candidates. There were two independent Labour candidates and 21 trade union-sponsored MPs who had previously been Liberals, who joined the party and created, prior to the January election of 1910, a bloc of 52. The January election of 1910 actually sees a decline of 12 MPs for Labour, who fell to 40. And then rose back up into 42 in December 1910, falling back again due to by-election losses in 1914 to 36 seats. So what does this suggest? Well, first it suggests that liberal social reform was very popular with the working classes, and it also suggests that the relationship that working class people in Great Britain had with the Labour Party wasn't as cut and dry as unconditional support. Very often there were working class people that identified with conservatism, that identified with the Liberals. They looked at these parties, the parties of their social betters, so to speak. There's an immense amount of kind of deference and the admiration of the upper classes that does shape working class attitudes considerably. I think I mentioned previously, looking at Gramsci a few podcasts ago, that there is nothing that Marx in Marx that predicts the possibility of working classes that vote against their own interests. But time and time again, it seems to happen. The Liberal government makes a series of social reforms, not simply as concessions to Labour, but some might argue that that's what was happening here. The Liberal governments were to some extent doing what they thought was genuinely necessary. In some instances, they were making concessions to Labour, and in some instances, they didn't want their Labour to steal their act. So you can suggest that the pressure from Labour brought about things such as the School Meals Act, which made sure that children were fed properly at school in 1906, the Trades Dispute Act in 1906, which reversed the Taft-Bell judgment, and very importantly, the introduction of pay for MPs in 1911. Prior to this, working class MPs were not able to take their seats in Parliament because they couldn't afford to. This is one thing that had stymied the Chartists almost a century beforehand. In the final years before the First World War, labour relations dramatically decline. In 1910, a huge coal strike broke out in South Wales, which led to virtual fighting on the streets in Tonopandy, where there were violent clashes and even one miner was killed. Winston Churchill, as the Home Secretary, sent in the army to deal with the situation. And there was the phenomena of sympathetic strikes by dock workers, which always presented the government with significant challenges because it meant that unions could coordinate to try to bring the government to their knees. In 1914, the Miners' Union, the Railway and Transport Workers' Federation, tried to create a triple alliance of unions to coordinate action together. This was what we would refer to as syndicalism, which was the use of unions really to bring about the overthrow of the capitalist system. And some might argue that the Liberal government itself is spared this crisis by the advent of the First World War. This is obviously the view of George Dangerfield, who famously wrote The Strange Death of Liberal England, and the idea that liberal England had been given an unnatural stay of life as a result of the First World War. Much of this militancy was not popular with the party itself, who had begun to develop as a parliamentary organisation, and the aspects of the party that were more radical certainly weren't revolutionary, and revolutionary tendencies within the party had been effectively strangled by the eve of the First World War. So there was militancy presents the party with a difficult situation. They have to appear to be sympathetic, but ultimately they view it as troublesome, dangerous and counterproductive. And a support for the parliamentary system is seen as paramount. Okay, well, I've gone on for long enough. I always tend to do this when I'm talking about the trade unions for some reason. But anyway, if you're a teacher and you're teaching this subject and you want more help, free lesson handouts, materials and stuff to make your classes really go with a bang, get my new newsletter. It's www.outstandinghistory.com/instant-access. Get that and I'll be sending you free study materials for your classrooms every Monday morning, every Friday night, and yeah, you'll like it. So outstandinghistory.com/instant-access. Get that, sign up, and there is an initial gift of 5 free lessons for you. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.